inflation, and I have on good authority Bayesian statistics, at least some, which actually is of passionate interest to many of us in the audience. So once again, we are going to try, but I'll try and help us organize our questions so that we don't get so detailed that we lose everybody in the audience. But once again, questions, interruptions, et cetera, are actually welcome instead of being discouraged, because that's what we're trying to do with these two-hour sessions. So go for it, Andrew.
Thanks, Dick. So what I want to tell you a bit about is inflation, which is the topic the organizers wanted me to talk about, but mostly cosmological model selection, which they probably didn't want me to talk about because no one likes statistics. But I think that it's an important subject, and I hope to convince you that it's both important and also that model selection statistics are of much wider interest than just cosmology, though certainly cosmology is one of the main places where we might like to apply them. So my plan, roughly speaking, is that I've got about 1 hour of material, I believe, though Leecher probably believed that as well. There. So there should be plenty of time for discussion. I'm going to spend about 20 minutes saying a few things about inflation. The reason I'm only spending 20 minutes is because, to be honest, there isn't that much to say about inflation. It hasn't been said by people many, many times before. Hopefully that will change when new data emerges, but really WMAP is the premier data set for analyzing inflation models, and so since it's now more than 2 years old, a lot of the things that can be done with it have been done. But anyway, I'll just start just by reminding you that this is the situation that we've got. This is the WMAP data. And I believe that if you want to explain this data, the simplest way is to put down these assumptions: that the universe is spatially flat, that it contains both dark matter and dark energy, and also that it contains initial perturbations which take on the simplest form, that they are adiabatic, Gaussian, and nearly scale invariant, which is what inflation gives us. And so this general picture is very much consistent with the simplest models of inflation. At some level, most of what I'm trying to tell you today is actually all about trying to justify the word simplest written up towards the top there, and what I might actually mean by simplest. The real theme of the talk is defining what's meant by the standard cosmological model, if you like. I'll mostly be talking about inflation, but as a slight change of topic towards the end, I also want to say a few things about dark energy as well, just as an alternative example of some things that can be done with the model selection statistics, which I'll be describing. I'm hoping I don't really need to explain what inflation is in any detail, or perhaps no detail at all. The definition of inflation is any period of the universe's evolution during which it's accelerating. So the scale factor double dot is greater than zero. In the old days, when we were working mainly on early universe inflation, it was always hard to convince astronomers that this was a reasonable thing at all, even in the early universe. But of course, nowadays, everyone pretty much accepts that the present universe is accelerating. This is the usual plot of the matter density and the cosmological constant running up this way. The division between accelerating and decelerating cosmologies runs along here, and all of this favored region from this rather old data set lies in the accelerating universe. So by my definition, the universe is inflating today, and that's certainly good motivation to believe that it might also have been able to undergo periods of inflation earlier in its history as well. I mentioned in passing that this particular definition, I think, is a very unhelpful definition, because no one has a very clear sense in their mind of what it means for the universe to be accelerating or decelerating. A much more helpful way to write it, which is equivalent, is this: h to the minus 1 is the Hubble length, which is the single characteristic scale, at least of a spatially flat universe. H to the minus 1 is in physical units, but in cosmology, everything's expanding, and it makes sense to factor out that expansion by dividing by the scale factor to get the co-moving Hubble length. And the condition for inflation is precisely that the co-moving Hubble length is decreasing with time rather than increasing. What I'd always advocate that you think of when you're talking about inflation is that you don't think that the whole universe is going zoom to some very large size. Instead, you should think in co-moving units all the time, so that everything just stays fixed, and ask how this characteristic scale of the universe, the Hubble length, evolves in those units. And what it does, by definition, is it shrinks in very dramatically. So I'd encourage you to think of inflation not as something that really expands up the universe, but rather it's like a microscope. The bit of the visible universe that you can see is really zooming in, and you see only a very small part of the initial universe with whatever late-time observations you have to hand. The main motivation for doing this, though, of course, is that early universe inflation is the most plausible explanation that we have for the origin of structure, given the observations that we have at our disposal, because those observations appear to indicate that the universe does have adiabatic, nearly Gaussian, nearly scale invariant perturbations. Inflation gives that, and also it appears that the perturbations have existed from a time when they were on super horizon scales, which is very hard to achieve other than by using this condition here. So what does inflation predict? Well, I'll go through it very, very quickly just to remind you why inflation is seen as a big success. It used to be that me and other people like me would write down this long list of predictions of inflation. There's basically, amongst the simplest models, by which I mean models with a single scalar field, there are six characteristic predictions written in red, and I'll summarize the state of play for each of them in a couple of slides' time there, but you can read them all. I think the simplest inflation models have one scalar field. There's no reason why there should only be one scalar field, but these models work, and so I regard it as a very useful working hypothesis to consider that class of models and to try and rule them out. If they were ruled out, then you might, depending on how they were ruled out, you might think that perhaps a more complicated inflation model was still viable, or you might think that, in fact, inflation should be given up. But at the moment, inflation is doing very well. In fact, of these six things, what we find is that WMAP, essentially on its own, gives no evidence against any of these 6 points, and it gives support to 5 of them, everything except the inevitable existence of tensor perturbations that you get in inflationary cosmology. So as such, WMAP gives us very, very strong general support for the inflationary paradigm, and that's the good message from WMAP. It doesn't uniquely support inflation. If someone like Neil Turok was here, he would point out that all of these predictions are predictions of the cyclic universe model, and indeed the cyclic universe model additionally predicts no tensor perturbations either, so even the sixth thing is in its favor. But nevertheless, I think inflation is a well-motivated model for explaining the data that we have to hand. I'll show you what is not really the current observational situation, but almost is. This is work from work a couple of years ago that I did with my former student, Sam Leach, who by then was a postdoc in Geneva, comparing this fairly typical data set, WMAP, a few other CMB things, 2DF galaxy redshift survey, in order to constrain inflation models. The two main predictions of inflation are that it has density perturbations, which are nearly scale invariant, and it predicts these tensor perturbations. And those are the two parameters shown in this plot here. So this is the spectral index of the perturbations. Here is seen to be of power law form. So n equals 1 is the scale invariant spectrum here. R is the ratio of tensor to scalar perturbations, defined out of convenience at 10. Or so. In response to a question that was asked this morning about the tensor ratio, and the best fit models actually live right down here with no tensors, so that is the best fit class of models people are discussing already. And it is partly true, I think, that the observational pressure on tensors is because they do tend to boost the quadrupole if you include them as compared to other multipoles. Well, I'm doing the half full now in these first 10 or 15 minutes, and all the rest of my talk is depression and misery. So if you just hang around. So this is what it looks like. There's a fairly chunky allowed region, and WMAP did really press down on the allowed region, but whenever anyone plots one of these figures, they always make the contours fill almost the whole area on the graph, so it looks like it didn't. But the old pre-WMAP contours would have been sort of this kind of thing, and the shrinking of the parameter areas by a factor of between 5 and 10 when WMAP data came along. R10, unfortunately, in this plot, what Sam chose to plot was the actual ratio of the CLs at the 10th multiple, which is perhaps not the most helpful thing to have plotted. It would be better just to plot the ratio of the power spectra at some fiducial scale. In this plot, our definition is about 3/4 of the one you'll see in the WMAP paper. So in WMAP, you find that the upper limit's 0.5, I think, 0.4, 0.5. Ours is the same upper limit, but different variable describing it, and you see it's down at 0.3 or so. It's just a translation factor, but there's not a unique factor either. It's an approximate factor, which depends on cosmological parameters. This is in sort of observational parameter space, spectral index and tensor to scalar ratio. We can also have a quick look at it in inflation parameter space, where it's just the same thing, only round the other way. And these are the two slow roll parameters. Epsilon basically is the tensor to scalar ratio, so no change there. And epsilon 2 is a parameter we like to use, is basically just 1 minus n, n minus 1, 1 minus n, whichever it is. They're running along this way. And so these are measuring the slope and the curvature of the inflationary potential. You will come to that at the end of the talk again, but there's is. Let's put it this way. You can prove, as I did in a paper in the mid-1990s, that if there are adiabatic perturbations on a significantly superhorizon scale, then the only choices you have are you can not believe causality, you can believe that inflation took place, or you can believe that the perturbations were already laid down at t equals zero and no dynamical mechanism can create them. And these are the only three possibilities you're allowed. I used to think that was a strong result, and it more or less demonstrated that inflation took place. But in fact, the ekperiotic or cyclic universe model violates causality in the four-dimensional sense, and that's how it does it. Yeah. The theorem I just described is a necessary condition to be able to create perturbations. It does not say that the inflationary mechanism for creating the perturbations was the one. You could have topological defects created and then inflated to be the perturbations, for example. But I think the fact that models which have perturbations on superhorizon scales fit the data is quite a strong indication that inflation is going the right direction. And that's particularly true of the TE polarization anti-correlation on large scales, which there's quite a lot of discussion in the WMAP paper, because that's very, very hard to arrange otherwise. Now I've got to figure out what I'm saying next. Nothing, apparently, according to my slide. But what I want to do is go through the six main red predictions of the simplest models of inflation, just to remind you what the status is. So the prediction was for nearly scale invariant spectrum. I contend, and will be contending later on in this talk, that the appropriate fit to the data is to make a power law fit to the data rather than a running spectral index fit to the data, for reasons I hope will become clear. And if you do that, the spectral index comes out to be something like 0.99 plus or minus 0.04, i.e. consistent with n equals 1, and definitely nearly scale invariant. I stress, as is common practice, every error bar I quote is only a 1 sigma error bar, and they always have to be treated with suspicion, whereas limits when quoted are 95% confidence limits. Adiabatic perturbations, well, we get a good fit to the data assuming there are only adiabatic perturbations, which means real, honest perturbations in the total density on uniform curvature hypersurfaces. I will say a little bit towards the end about the possibility of isocurvature perturbations from a data perspective, but I should also note that it's perfectly plausible that more complicated models of inflation might create them, but I'm doing the simplest ones. Gaussianity used to be simple, now it's more complicated, so I think the phrase I like to say is that there's no unambiguous evidence of primordial non-Gaussianity. There is endless evidence of non-Gaussianity in the WMAP data of various kinds. Most of it is ambiguous, and certainly I think no one would bet their life on it being primordial rather than some other effect. So as yet, I think the Gaussian perturbation hypothesis is fine. Tensor perturbations are not seen. We would find a 95% upper limit of R of 0.43. This R is now in the WMAP units, but it's slightly less than the WMAP limit because we're using a power law fit rather than a running spectral index fit there. Growing mode perturbations, I don't want to labor the growing mode perturbation issue, but growing modes are what means that the inflationary perturbations have the oscillatory structure in the microwave background, because the fact that the perturbations were laid down very early on and that they solve a second order differential equation means that you have two modes of perturbation, but in order to get the oscillatory structure, only one of those modes can dominate. And if you lay the perturbations down early enough, then the decaying mode decays away, you only have the growing mode, and you then see the peak structure. If the perturbations are created instead much later in the evolution, there's no reason to think the decaying mode should be negligible. And then there's no reason to think you would get a peak structure in the anisotropies. but you do. And further evidence of that is also this temperature polarization anti-correlation on large scales. Spatial flatness, again, I want to say something about spatial flatness later on. It depends, again, which fit to the data you use. So as Leach has stressed, you need to have a strong prior on the Hubble parameter in order to get a limit as tight as this in your data compilation. But that seems perfectly reasonable to me. And so putting all of these things together, the glass half full part of the talk says that the simplest inflation models are actually doing very, very well in light of the data. And not that long ago, there wasn't really any particular support for any of these things, and maybe the nearly scale invariant power spectrum, but nothing else at all until the era of Boomerang and then later on after that. So I think that's all pretty good. I mentioned in passing that, of course, there are more complicated models of inflation for which there is no evidence at the moment, but we might as well have a look at some of the possibilities to get an idea for the more general inflationary phenomenology. I think it's very important to study these more general models, because if you don't understand the range of phenomena that are associated with the models you're trying to fit, then you're not in nearly such a good position in terms of trying to understand what the data are telling you. So we want to take guidance wherever possible from theoretical ideas such as they exist. Simplest thing is multi-field models, which allow isocurvature perturbations, and they allow those to be correlated with the adiabatic ones, and that will be one of my main illustrations of model selection later on. A kind of subgenre of that, this with slightly different motivations, the curvaton, which was mentioned this morning by Paolo Cremonelli, where the perturbations are really created after inflation. The perturbations were still laid down during the inflationary epoch, but in a second scalar field, which is subdominant during inflation, it only comes to dominance thereafter. It's an interesting idea, and it's particularly interesting in the context of non-Gaussianity. It's probably much more natural to introduce non-Gaussianity by this kind of mechanism than by the multi-field models that people have discussed. And you can get the FNL parameters no longer constrained to be of order one or of order the slow roll parameters. It can easily be much larger. The other thing that a lot of inflation people do these days is brain world stuff. Either you've heard about the brain world or you haven't, but basically it's an opportunity to build inflation models in many different ways and with different motivations. And I seldom understand what anyone's doing in this field, but it seems to be quite an interesting area. The one thing I have done, which is a bit depressing, is that at least in the simplest brain world scenario, which is the Randall syndrome type 2 model, it turns out that there are no distinctive observational signatures from the way that perturbations are created during inflation. They're different, but in terms of the observational quantities, both the brain world inflation models and the standard inflation models can completely populate the space of possible values of the spectral index and the tensor to scalar ratio. So if you find if the observations point to one particular place in that observational plane, you have a degenerate interpretation of them, either as being from a standard cosmological model with such and such a potential, or a brain world inflation model with some different potential, but you have no way of telling which is which. That, I think, is one of the most important points to bear in mind, actually, about inflation in particular, is that if you make more complicated models, typically you might have more parameters, more complexity, better motivation from fundamental physics, but there are a very limited number of things that we can actually measure observationally. And so if you have more different ideas, then quite often what you find is there's no characteristic signature, but you've got suddenly new degeneracies in interpreting your observations. The same observations can have arisen in yet another different kind of inflationary model. So miraculously, I do seem to have done that first bit in the 20 minutes I promised. I think I might maybe briefly stop for some questions on the inflation part before changing topic to the standard cosmological model. Do you have any questions? We've got...
This is probably a specious question, but a technical question. When you calculate the fluctuations in the usual way with Euclidean, the Euclidean or Minkowski background, then you're going from a classical homogeneous isotropic universe through a quantum calculation and back to a classical universe. So depending on how you do the calculation of the quantum expectation values, you can either end up with zero fluctuations at the end. There's an ambiguity there. There's a paper recently by Zdarsky et al. Where they go into this in some detail. So people have suggested stochastic inflation to deal with this.
Right. I'm not familiar with the paper you mentioned, and it wasn't aware that there was an ambiguity. And as far as I can see, the calculation people do, which is done in whatever the expanding universe is that the inflation model generates, appears self-consistent to me, and only uses the Heisenberg picture of quantum mechanics, where all the quantization can be done in the flat space limit while modes are inside the horizon. And then you can just use the classical evolution of the mode operators to take them outside.
But the problem is that you have to choose how you get from the quantum to the back to the classical. And if you do the expectation value calculations in different ways, you get different answers. And anyway, there's...
I'm not aware of that. I'm sure it's not true in calculations I've seen, but maybe there's different ways of doing it which appear to create ambiguities. I think, and I would be more worried in this context about so-called trans-Planckian effects and about whether or not the quantum initial condition that's imposed well inside the horizon really is well justified or not, and whether or not those effects might be translated outside the horizon and made classical. I think that's an entirely different question to the question you're asking, however, which I'm failing to answer. Other questions?
My name is Paul Frampton, and I'm a long-term visitor here at the moment.
So you can say I'm an alcoholic. So you can say I'm Paul Frampton and I'm an alcoholic. It's just the way you said it. Kind of 12-step program. Sorry. Yeah,
I've never been to an AA meeting, so I don't know. I don't understand that. I don't expect this to happen, but supposing the measurement of omega led to a value which differed from eventually from 1 by certain standard deviations, what would you... How would that affect your support for inflation?
I think a question like that, in a way, doesn't depend specifically on the value of omega that's seen. I mean, I think the strong reasons for believing in inflation are that you have adiabatic superhorizon perturbations. If observations went in such a way that that assumption remained valid, but the spatial curvature was indicated, then it would certainly be possible to make inflation models that were not spatially flat. People like Neil Turok have done that. And that would perhaps remain an interesting possibility. However, it may be that in the same process as discovering that the universe is not spatially flat, that it's discovered that the perturbations have some more complicated form as well. And then it may be back to the drawing board, and you can't second guess what kind of unfortunate observations are going to come your way. But inflation's a package, right? There were these six things which I wrote down, and I think if you had to unpick just one of them, you could probably find an inflationary way of accommodating that you might be happy with. The more of these six things that get wiped out by observation, the less happy you would be, and the more you would be praying for someone to come along with a smarter idea. I think it tends to be a bit fruitless to try and anticipate what might happen in the face of adverse observational outcomes, because you just, you know, whatever actually happens will be more adverse and unexpected than anything you can think of. Fair enough? Oh, really? Okay. Can't actually see anyone from up here, the way the lights work. Okay, so standard cosmological model. This is a bit of a mixed collection of topics, but my general aim is to try and convince you of a couple of things. One of them is we need to get a bit smarter about the statistics that we use in cosmology. Now, Leitch already mentioned that we apparently use Stone Age statistics. Maybe that's true. What I'm hoping to bring us towards is perhaps maybe the Iron Age or something in terms of the statistics literature, which we are very far behind. We need to get smarter with our statistics because the observations are so good. And the kinds of questions that we can be asking are things like, how do you actually define what you mean by the standard cosmological model? And what criteria can you introduce to define it, which robustly allow you to develop the standard cosmological model in light of future precision observations? And then centered around that is the whole idea of what you're actually trying to do with your cosmological observations and how you can hone your future observational plans in order to maximize your chances of achieving the things you're setting out to achieve. So those are the themes. But my starting point is to say, what is the standard cosmological model? Because everyone already at this meeting has discussed the standard cosmological model. And mostly seem to think that it exists. The trouble is, people don't actually agree on what the standard cosmological model is, even though they agree there is a standard cosmological model. Different people have subtly different views as to exactly what constitutes it. And that's the question I want to try and not resolve, but at least address during this talk. Now, there's two reasons why people don't agree on what the standard cosmological model is. One, which is obvious, and the other is slightly less obvious, at least. One is that the observational constraints you get depend on the observations you've got. Very obvious. It would be very, very strange if they didn't. So obviously, whenever new data come in, whatever you thought the cosmological model was will change in some way. But more important, I think, or at least what I want to talk about today, is the choice of the set of cosmological parameters that define the cosmological model. That is to say, what are the parameters that you're going to allow to vary in your fit to the data? It turns out that what you think the standard cosmological model is depends on that as well, and that different people make different choices. I've already alluded to one today in saying that a lot of the WMAP headline results quoted assuming a running spectral index cosmological model, whereas I've quoted a number of variables assuming a power law cosmological model. And these are two different cosmological models, and having assumed, made two different assumptions, then we finish up getting slightly different results for things like the spectral index or the tensor to scalar ratio, etc. This I came to realize when I was writing a couple of years ago with Ofer Lahav. We were writing an article for the Reviews of Particle Physics, which is this big thing sometimes called the Particle Data Group book. We've been told that we ought to write an article on cosmological parameters, and so we did. But at the same time, other people were writing articles, for instance, on the cosmic microwave background or on nucleosynthesis. And those of you who are familiar with this big fat book will know that they really like their summary tables where all the information is condensed down. And in particular, they expected that there's going to be a standard table of values of cosmological parameters. And it turned out that wasn't the case. When they looked at the different articles, all of us had chosen different best fits to the data because we'd either chosen different data sets or we'd even chosen different cosmological models to fit. So just to focus on one thing, let's focus on the baryon density, which is running along the bottom here. It's the only one I care about today. This is table 7, is it, from the original WMAP paper, Spergel et al. And if you look at the baryon density, the columns refer to different observational data sets. And unsurprisingly, the values for the baryon density change as you change your observational data set. So you start with 0.024 plus or minus 0.01. And by the time you've gone on and added the Lyman alpha, you've got something which is quite a bit lower. In fact, outside the 1 sigma error bars of the first number. And that's what you should expect, because 1 sigma results are very, very, very far from being robust. And if you introduce new data, you shouldn't be surprised at all if it moves that far. But what's much more worrying is there's also table 8 in the WMAP Spergel et al. Paper as well. This is table 8, which looks very similar, but instead of assuming a power law spectrum of initial perturbations, it assumes a running spectral index. So you look at the baryon densities again, and you find that the numbers aren't the same, even though the data sets are the same. And that's because you've made a different assumption about the cosmological model you're going to fit to the data. Now here, the difference is not very significant in this instance here. Basically, it's a 1 sigma drift in the result. It's the sort of thing that, in this case, doesn't make anyone really care very much because it's just a change in a number. But at the same time, it stops you writing a number into the particle data group as being the definitive omega baryon from the current cosmological data set here. Let's say, I'm glad that Leecha mentioned that this is only 1 sigma change, because one of the points that this highlights, which we'll be coming back to later, is that no one actually cares what the value of cosmological parameters is. I exaggerate a little bit, but Leecha clearly doesn't actually care whether the baryon density is 0.023 or 0.024, and I have to say I don't care either. So a lot of what we're trying to do is nothing to do with how accurately we measure the parameters, even though almost all the experiments we do are motivated by how well they can measure parameters. And that's exactly the sort of contradictory position that I hope to alleviate in the things I'll be saying later on in this talk. So we better move on. Parameter estimation then, described as the Stone Age by Leecher this morning. Parameter estimation is what almost everyone does when faced with a pile of cosmological data. In parameter estimation, you decide which parameters are going to be fit to the data yourself. You just make whatever choice you see fit to do. And then the aim of parameter estimation exercise is to find the values of these parameters. And the usual technique is a likelihood analysis of some kind. So here's an example of Sloan plus WMAP. Again, I don't really care too much about the exact values of the parameters, but WMAP alone, I think, is the yellow, and then Sloan plus WMAP is the red. And here, Tegmark et al. Have chosen 10 cosmological parameters to vary and got some results. No doubt if I looked at their baryon density number, it's probably different again to the one I had before. There. Very good. So you do this. The maximum likelihood value tells you the best value of the parameters, but you should never care what the best value is. You're interested in the range of plausible values given by some interval around that, which gives you confidence limits. So there are a very, very large number of papers that do this. Model selection is not parameter estimation. Model selection is something different. In the statistics literature, parameter estimation is sometimes called the first level of statistical inference. Model selection is the second level of statistical inference. This is nomenclature used, for example, in a very good book by Dave Mackay, which I recommend you get, which is very thick and very entertaining. And model selection, what you try to do is distinguish between different cosmological models. And cosmological models mean choices of the parameters you're going to fit to the data. And in model selection, you don't care what the values of the parameters are. It's the models that you're comparing with each other. And the most important feature of these different models is model dimensionality, which is the number of parameters in the fit to the data. So that's going to be one of the key drivers for distinguishing between different models. Just to give us an idea of what we ought to be starting with, I'm going to define a baseline cosmological model, which I think is the standard cosmological model, and which again disagrees with what everyone said this morning, because at least two separate speakers said that you could do really, really well against current data with a 6-parameter model. And that's true, but actually you only need 5. Because everyone included the spectral index of density perturbations, but in fact, you don't need the spectral index of density perturbations. The Harrison-Zaldovich spectrum gives a perfectly good fit to the observational data. And Harrison-Zaldovich thought about it long before anyone ever thought about inflation. Especially me, have become so conditioned by being told about inflation that you just put the spectral index in as a variable parameter without even thinking about it. But as we'll see, there's no observational motivation for that whatsoever. And in fact, the standard cosmological model should feature 5 real parameters, which are these 5. And then we normally have to include 2 phenomenological parameters in order to fit to the data. The phenomenological parameters, I mean, they're things that in principle you really ought to be able to calculate if you were clever enough, but at the moment we can't, so we have to try and fit them from the data. So these are the ingredients. I stress this model does have dark energy. It's not listed here because the model is spatially flat, so the dark energy density is obtained by making the density parameters add up to each other. It's determined by the condition that the total densities add up to 1. So there is dark energy, but it's not a variable parameter because it's decided by the values that the other variable parameters have already obtained. There. Equally, the neutrino density is not included in this model because it can be, assuming thermal interactions, it can be related to the radiation density here. So this is, I think, the standard cosmological model, as far as I'm concerned, for reasons I'll try and justify later with some actual calculations. But the reason why I think you have to have it is to stress that there are an awful lot of ways in which this basic cosmological model can be extended. And what we have to do as cosmologists is get to grip with the fact that there are a very large number of ways. So when I was writing a paper a couple of years ago, I thought I'd better try and figure out what sort of parameters we might have to deal with in the cosmological model. So I looked at some papers, and an incomplete set of parameters that have already been fit to data compilations is the following set of at least 20 cosmological parameters that could be included in the cosmological model if you wanted. And for reasons I'll describe in a second, it's very damaging, in fact, to believe that these things can be included because they degrade your ability to learn anything from observations if you do nothing to moderate which parameters are included. So there's a whole pile of them, and I doubt it's complete in any way, but the ones up here are parameters that you could associate with the homogeneous cosmological model, usually by changing its matter content. For instance, introducing dark energy in place of the cosmological constant, or varying fundamental constants, something like that. And then all of these parameters are the parameters that describe the initial perturbations in the universe, where again, there's lots of things you can include. The scalar spectral index is one, which is typically included. And then you have the running, then you can have more general initial perturbations, which are adiabatic, you can have tensors, you can have isocurvature, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's about 20 of these. So the aim of model selection is to try and get to grips with the fact that there are a very, very large number of possible cosmological models, at least, I don't know, 20 factorial possible cosmological models that I could invent if I wanted to by combinations of these parameters. And the question is, how can we compare these different models with each other, in particular trying to say which of the different models is the best, which is the choice of parameters? And it's very, very important that you do this, because if you add extra parameters, like the scalar spectral index, for example, then of course you almost invariably discover that the maximum likelihood increases, that is, the best fit to the data is better whenever you add an extra parameter. And that has nothing to do with whether the parameter is a real parameter describing some real physics in the universe or not. It's just a generic feature that if you have an entire extra direction, parameter direction in your model space, by statistical fluke, you ought to be able to find models which fit the data better. And that's something which is very worrying. You cannot use the maximum likelihood to decide whether parameters are good or not in its own right. Not in this form, anyway. I'll come back to a bit about chi-squared per degree of freedom a little bit later, which is the usual thing that people do in order to try and assess this point. The second problem, which is perhaps the more severe one, is that you can't just allow the extra parameters to be included in your analysis and fit to the data, because whenever you include any extra parameters, physical or not, that invariably degrades your ability to measure the parameters you started off with, like the baryon density. Because again, you have extra directions in parameter space, so that creates new degeneracies that allow you to fit the data with a wider range of values of the baryon density. What people have found, for example, is if you start allowing the power spectrum to be specified in wave bands, and you have many wave bands, you very quickly discover you can't measure anything at all, because you have complete degeneracy of the initial perturbations with the cosmological parameters. So what you have to do, and you have no choice, what you have to do is find a way of penalizing extra parameters by some Occam's razor mechanism. And that's what model selection does for you there. And does so in more or less an objective way rather than a subjective way. The evidence is what I want to mainly talk about, though it is not quite equivalent to marginalizing with respect to everything. So Joao has just said one of the things I wanted to say. Here, let's see, get back to the right place now. Here. Model selection is all about model selection statistics. That is to find a statistic which enables you to rank different cosmological models against each other. I stress again, a model selection statistic is something which is associated to a model. That is a particular choice of parameters, and is not necessarily anything to do with the best fit parameter values within that model, which is the exercise that parameter estimation does. So there's a pile of these things in the literature, and when I was first thinking about this a couple of years ago, I was mostly focused on the first two because they were easy to implement. But as Rouse just said, the evidence is actually a superior measure and the one I would advocate you using, and in fact the one with the oldest heritage as well. I'll start by just mentioning the information criteria, particularly the Akaiki one, because it shows you a very simple form of what a model selection statistic is supposed to do for you. What they always do is set up a tension between how well your model can fit the data and how complicated your model is. So the general form, the Akaiki information criterion looks like this, invented by Akaiki in 1974, one of the classic papers in science, more than 3,000 citations. There, and it has this very simple form. It actually refers only to the best fit parameter values of your model, which is its main weakness, actually, is that it does that. So having chosen your parameters, you then find the best fit you can to the data, and that's this L max here. And then we're doing log likelihood as a -2, so this is basically the chi-squared in the usual terminology here. You want to make this as small as possible to fit the data well. So L max as large as possible. And then this term here is the number of parameters in your model, and this is a penalty term which increases the information criterion as you make your model more complicated. So generically what happens is if you start with a very, very simple model, it's probably not complicated enough to fit the data. The AIC is very large because you don't fit the data well and the first term kills you. As you add parameters, you can fit the data much better, so the curve comes down, but eventually you hit the point of diminishing returns where the new parameters aren't helping you anymore. They don't really improve the fit to the data. And then the second term, the penalty term, starts to bring you back up again. So the generic shape is always a curve like that, and the preferred model is the one that minimizes the value of the AKK information criterion. There is no motivation. Well, I'll tell you where it comes from on the next slide, but I would not advocate using this. Still linear in parameters, but more complicated version is a thing called the Bayesian information criterion. I'm very keen to advocate the use of Bayesian statistics in this talk, in particular the Bayesian evidence. The Bayesian information criterion is very similar to the Akaiki one, but is an approximation to the Bayesian evidence and is derived via Bayesian statistics. It's the same general form, but an interesting thing about it is that here you have the log of the number of data points. Log of about 7 equals 2, so if you had 7 data points, these two things are equivalent. If you had more than 7 data points, then the Bayesian information criterion is more restrictive against introducing new parameters. There's a problem using this in cosmology, however, which is that you can always write this down, but it only approximates the evidence if the data points are independent and identically distributed, and in cosmology that assumption is generally a poor one. In particular, in data like WMAP, you have to bin it quite heavily before you had much chance of obeying those conditions. So the best one actually looks quite different. The Bayesian evidence, which, as Joao said, is essentially the marginalized likelihood of the model over all of the parameters, though you need some caution in computing it, as I will describe. So here it looks completely different, but actually serves the same function as these ones here. This is now the likelihood of the model over the whole parameter space. And here, this is the prior parameter space, so this is what you thought of the model before the data came along. This is the likelihood from the fit to the data. So this is the average likelihood. If you take all of the models that you thought were reasonable, so all of the parameter values that you thought were reasonable before the data came along, the statistic asks, how well on average did they fit the data? It doesn't ask how well the best models within that parameter space fit the data. What this is essentially doing is rewarding predictiveness of your model. If your model is highly predictive and fits the data quite well, then its average likelihood will be high over all parameter values. If your model didn't make a very strong prediction, so you had a very wide range of predictions from your models, then most of them won't fit the data because you have a wide range of predictions, and the average likelihood will be poor for that reason. Mm-hmm. It does not bother me that it depends a lot on the prior, but it does depend a lot. It depends to some extent on the priors. It depends on the details of your problem, whether it depends really significantly on the priors or not. Shall I give you the microphone?
I was just criticizing these on the grounds that actually the evidence depends on the prior, or it can depend quite strongly on the prior. And people usually say, oh, priors, if you don't know anything about the parameter, then you have a uniform distribution a priori. But then you get into the issue, what is the parameter, what function? Because if you take a function of something which is uniformly distributed, yeah, it no longer is uniformly distributed.
Yeah.
And you can get quite different results sometimes, including estimations of the power spectrum.
That is true, and that is also fine. I mean, the issue here is under what circumstances can you draw robust conclusions from your data? If you have a very strong prior dependence and no guidance as to which prior you should choose, then that's just telling you that you cannot draw robust conclusions from the data within the uncertainty given by these possible priors.
The thing I have in mind is that not so much the parameters you've given, but suppose we really want CLs, one by one. And suppose we have this whole issue, what is the uniform prior? Is it the chi-square? Is it the LMs? What is it? you can actually get very different results, which means, according to your philosophy, that we should not be talking in terms of CLs.
I think that the framework I'm discussing is not well suited to determining the actual CLs, if that's what you want to do. I want to compare different models with different numbers of parameters. Estimating the CLs is a parameter estimation problem, not a model selection problem. It is also dependent on the priors, but that's not, it's just not the problem I'm discussing. It's a question at the back, and whether you want to pass the microphone backwards. That's not particularly the direction I'm going, in fact, rather the opposite. I mean, first of all, there are two kinds of priors in this. There are model priors and there are parameter priors. And within Bayesian inference, you have to know both in order to compute the what you call a posterior model probability. People try to create... The thing you're used to thinking of, this PR here, is the prior on parameters. That's right. There is additionally a prior on the model as well. Each model that you consider has a prior model probability that people normally set to one. People try to introduce criteria for fixing the priors, so they use entropy criteria or whatever. I tend to feel that that's rather fruitless in general for the kinds of problems that we deal with in cosmology, though it may be useful in things like image reconstruction problems. But I'm sure there is no unique prescription within Bayesian inference. These things are for you, the person who's doing the analysis, to specify, and there are no criteria.
Let me just ask a general question then. Has anyone pursued Balasubramanian's ideas in the context of fitting cosmological models? He proposes a way, which he claims to be a unique way, to find the prior for in the model space robustness rather than in the parameter space.
I'll say one sentence, then pass to Licia. I know Roberto Trotta at Oxford is considering methods of defining parameters, which may or may not be the same. I'm not familiar with the Balasubramanian.
So I gave this project to Roberto Trotta, and I'm working with Vijay Balasubramanian in considering this. And you can show that in some context, the second equation written there is the first term in a Taylor expansion of VJ full expression. Mm-hmm. So there's some connection there. But his formulation, it's in theory, can be written down very nicely. But in practice, when you actually want to apply to a real problem in cosmology, you end up with numerical and computational limitations. So that's basically the main limitation right now.
Jim?
Framework of the first two things.
Which one is more restrictive? Is it reasonable to bin the data into groups of where I'd get 100 for n, or?
I don't really know the answer. Nowadays, I would just advocate you calculate the Bayesian evidence, because I think that used not to be possible, but for reasons I'll describe now, it's much more possible than it used to be. I think the BIC is useful only insofar as it approximates the evidence, because then it has the interpretation of being the relative model probabilities, as I will describe on the next slide. I don't know how much binning of the WMAP, Sloan, et cetera, data would be necessary. I would anticipate that you would still have, 20 data points of each, something like that, would probably be sufficient to render them independent. The identically distributed is a more subtle issue. And actually, probably this could be enhanced in order to allow for non-identically distributed data, because once you've made them independent, you can rescale them. But I think that's probably missing the point, in the sense that you'd be better off just calculating the thing that you want to calculate, which is the evidence.
Well, it'd be nice to know how these things compare for people who would like to do something a little bit better than just add parameters, but they are not running chains, so they can't.
That's right. I have used this, and I have used this, and the results I've got from each have been the same in the cosmological applications I've done. But that's not to say that they would be true, that they would match in examples that you might do. So there's no quality seal of approval I can offer you. Question. Yeah, it's not to my knowledge. It's funny, actually, in the statistics literature, the Akaike information criterion is much more widely used because it's an information theory quantity, and a lot of statisticians seem to prefer it. There's only fairly limited reference to the Bayesian information criterion in the literature. There's a nice review article by Cass and Raftery from the mid-90s, but that derives this from this, but does not try to derive further corrections. It might be that what Leecha said a few seconds ago was to do with the further corrections. But if those corrections turn out to be important, then you have no guarantee that the whole hierarchy of corrections isn't important. So again, you'd be better off calculating this in the first place, I think. There's a question way at the back there.
Can you stand up, introduce yourself, and speak up?
Does it? I'm definitely not saying that. What I'm moving towards in this talk is criteria for introduction of new parameters. So all I've said so far is that you can explain the data quite well without including W not equal to minus 1. But the whole point of this framework is to allow you to assess when you ought to think that you do need to include W as a separate fit parameter to the data. Okay, so very briefly say what these things are. I'm going to start with the evidence, because it's the most useful one, even though it was the last one on the previous slide here. There's just lots of text. Sorry about that. You can read it probably faster than I can read it for you. The Bayesian evidence is part of the whole Bayesian inference framework. It has the literal interpretation of being the probability of the data you received in light of the model that you're assuming. And if you remember Bayes' theorem, that means it's the thing that you multiply the prior model probability with to get the posterior model probability. So the idea here is you might say two competing models. Let's say it's a Harrison's-Odovich spectrum versus a varying spectral index model. You've got these two models. Before the data comes in, you have some feeling for the relative merits of these two models, which you might think are equal, for example. Then the evidence is the thing that you multiply that initial probability with to get the probability of the model after the data comes in. And then you've got the probabilities of all the models, however many you're considering, so you have a ranked list of the models from the best one to the worst one. This is different, for instance, to using likelihood ratio test, which is the likelihood version of the chi-squared per degree of freedom test, because in that case you have to actually set an arbitrary significance level that you decide means that you should include new parameters, which people usually set at 95% confidence. I mentioned in passing that that is inconsistent with Bayesian inference, because Bayesian inference tells you that the threshold for accepting new parameters depends both on your model, your prior knowledge of the model, and on the type of data as well. And so the idea that there just is a thing called a 95% confidence level that works in all regimes all the time, you can think that if you want. You're welcome to do so, but it is inconsistent with Bayesian reasoning, at least, and is not consistent with any known reasoning system. Anyway, the evidence is a good thing. It is unfortunately difficult to calculate generally, because as many of you know, likelihood function tends to be very highly peaked somewhere in parameter space. But unfortunately, it tends not to be so highly peaked that you can approximate it by a simple function like a Gaussian. You do have to compute it across the prior, and it's a multidimensional integral. You might have 6 model parameters, you might have 8 or 10. So it's reasonably challenging to compute. Bayesian information criterion, I think I've said all this now in response to questions. It is a Bayesian statistic, but it's defined or stated by statisticians to be a crude approximation to the Bayesian evidence that may or may not work well depending on circumstances. It has become my opinion that it should be avoided. As for the Akaike one, I'm very much inclined to think it should be avoided as well, but for what it's worth, there's a thing in information theory called the Kullback-Leibler information entropy. And if you find the model that minimizes the Akaike information criterion, it minimizes this, which measures the difference between the true distribution of the data and the model distribution. Then in the statistics literature, you find a lot of reference to the fact that the Akaiki information criteria tends to accept models which are more complicated than the true model in simulated data. It has a property which is called dimensional inconsistency, which says that even if you have an infinitely large data set, then the Akaiki information criterion is not guaranteed to select the correct model, whereas the Bayesian information criterion is guaranteed to select the correct model if you have an infinite data set, because it has the log n dependence on the number of data points. So I would say this is also to be treated with some considerable caution. Okay, how are we doing? Pretty well. So model selection, I want to emphasize, model selection techniques, I believe, are essential in trying to decide whether data requires new cosmological parameters. And there's been various examples already mentioned today. One you might want to think of is the issue of the running of the spectral index, which obviously became quite popular when WMAP arrived. The question is, under what circumstances is the data good enough to justify a parameter like that being included in order to describe some new real physical effect that you found in the universe? So let me show you a couple of examples. They're kind of non-examples, but they're quite fun in a way just to show what's going on. I'll start with the spatial curvature. The simplest cosmological model assumes the universe is spatially flat. Now, WMAP, under certain assumptions about priors, has a headline number for the total density, which is 1.02 plus or minus 0.02. Now, all the sensible people here know that this is a one sigma error, and therefore there is no significant evidence against the spatially flat universe. But nevertheless, you do find people from time to time saying that this actually indicates that the universe is favored to be slightly closed. And that's been used in various contexts as motivation. In the framework of model selection, that statement is wrong. And I can demonstrate it by a very hand-waving calculation. Let me just assume that, not entirely correctly, but let me assume that the likelihood is actually a Gaussian. So if it was well approximated by Gaussian, then this is the form it would have. It's not normalized. The prefactor is L naught, is however good the best fitting model is to the data. And what I'm going to do is compare two models. What I'm going to assume is that I've got the spatially flat model, and then I've got a model with one extra parameter, which is the spatial curvature. So these are the two different models. And as Joao was stressing, I have to choose a prior on my parameter. How wide a range? So I thought, well, you know, my exact result will depend a little bit what I choose here. But something like 0.1 to 2 seems to me a reasonable range for plausible models from some time before you had data that you could really measure this thing with. There. You might think it's wider or narrow. Anyway, this is the range. And I've already marginalized over all the other parameters by saying I can write the likelihood just as a function of omega total like this. So I can compute the evidence for each of the models. Very easy. The flat model, remember, it's the average likelihood of the models. The flat model just has omega equals 1. It's a single point in parameter space. At omega equals 1, I evaluate this exponential. I get 0.6 times L naught. It's not the best fitting model, which would have L naught, but it's done pretty well. The curved model, the evidence is the average likelihood. So I've got the prior width, 1.9 comes from that. Integral over the Gaussian, evaluated, it's 0.03 L naught. And hence, according to this calculation, remember, the evidence is the posterior model probability, if I assume that the models were equally likely beforehand. According to this calculation, the flat model is a much better description of the data than the curved model, which has an extra parameter. And the odds ratio is about 20 to 1. So if you were a betting person and someone offered you the odds, 20 to 1 is approximately the right odds for the universe being precisely spatially flat, rather than being spatially curved and happening to have a value somewhere around this preferred number here. I have, in saying that, assumed that the two models are equally likely. And you don't have to assume that. There's a prior model probability that you're also free to choose. Not everyone will agree on what they think the prior model probability is, and hence not everyone will agree on what the posterior model probability is. But everyone will agree on how those changed. The ratio of evidences is 20 to 1. So regardless of what you thought about your model before the data came along, everyone agrees that the curved model is now 20 times less likely than it was before the data comes along. So that's a very simple application, and it tells us that the curvature is not a useful parameter and fitting to current data. It actually tells us something stronger than that. It tells us it's quite unlikely that spatial curvature will ever be measured in the future, because it is much more likely that the universe is precisely flat than that it is curved and happens to have omega naught in that range between, I don't know, 0.98 and 1.06, or something like that. And to stress in this calculation, another point of interest in it, it happened at W. Can I maybe just make one more point and then take questions, just to speed through this bit here? As it happened, the WMAP data said 1.02 plus or minus 0.02, which isn't going to fool anyone. But in fact, even if WMAP had said omega total is 1.05 plus or minus 0.02, now imagine it said that. Anyone who does parameter estimation suddenly thinks, hang on, this is actually 97% result, something like that. Starts jumping up and down saying, we've discovered spatial curvature. Parameter estimation says that, but model selection does not. If I'd substituted in 1.05 into here instead of 1.02, this number here would still have been bigger than this number, and the spatially flat model would still have been preferred. And the point to make there is that model selection sets much more stringent criterion, typically, for a new parameter to be seen as interesting. And in this particular example, because this prior is quite wide, a 2.5 sigma detection is not good enough. And it's still preferred, in fact, the universe is spatially flat. The other point I should make about this before taking the question from John over there is that all of this, you have to decide what your models are before the data comes along. You're not allowed to say afterwards. Now that the data's here, you can't say, well, hang on, though, there's a model with omega equals 1.02, which is the best model, because it's a single point, which is the best fit to the data. That's true, but you've chosen it a posteriori, and there's no particular meaning to doing that. Only if someone before WMAP came along had said they had a model of the universe which predicted this value, definitely that value, they could then say WMAP data did support that over and above the flat model. So to John's question, if I haven't answered it.
Yes, in view of this statement, does this mean that you're excluding the dodecahedron or football model of the universe, Lumine et al., who claim to fit, for example, the loss of quadrupole power?
I'm saying that from the WMAP data, the preferred description is that the universe is flat. If you add in extra data, it may overturn that. So the extra data that goes in for the dodecahedron is still WMAP data, but it's doing an analysis of correlations of circles in the sky. And if you believed that data and included it, then it would overturn the model comparison I've made, because the flat model would not be able to explain that data, and the dodecahedral model would be. However, I don't think people widely believe that the dodecahedral model is favored at any particular significance, but I'm not an expert in that.
If I add a model with two extra parameters that are highly degenerate,
If I have a model with two degenerate parameters, or two parameters that are highly degenerate, will I be penalized? How will I be penalized relative to just adding one parameter?
It is a drawback of the evidence that it does not discriminate against perfectly degenerate parameters, because it's the average likelihood. So if you have a parameter direction where the likelihood is completely flat, you can just integrate along it, and that direction will disappear. So if you know you have these sort of degenerate combinations, this evidence will not help you, unfortunately. It's only parameters that the likelihood does depend on that the evidence is useful.
But will I be penalized as much for adding, or more for adding those two parameters as if they weren't?
If you add in two parameters but there's one degeneracy, you'll be penalized as if you'd added in one parameter.
Okay.
Suppose I was of Copernicus, and I began with a Tycho Brahe data, and I tried circles, circular orbits. It didn't quite work, but it almost worked. Mm-hmm. So I had to doctor it up. So then I put epicycles mm-hmm. to get it right. So I'm just as bad as Ptolemy was before. From these kind of analyses, would the information theory give me some indication that I'm barking up the wrong tree, and that I should change the initial hypotheses that the orbits were circles, and I should have deformed the orbits the way Kepler did after me?
I think the point is that the statistics allow you to compare models, but you have to be smart enough in the first place to think of the models. So if you were Kepler and you wander in with your elliptical planet thing, then suddenly you can fit the data probably better and with far fewer parameters, and then these statistics make you win easily. But if you weren't smart enough to think that you needed to use elliptical orbits, then no, unfortunately. And we all have to use our judgment as to when our models become too baroque and contrived and to look more actively for ways out. You know, maybe people would say that the dark matter, dark energy thing is an example of that, that we, once you've got two dark things, you really ought to be scratching your head and thinking of something better. Well, I can't, so I assume not. I say self-contradictory. Yeah.
I'm not going to argue. Oh, I'm Peter Coles, by the way. I probably am an alcoholic, in fact. But I don't want to argue against your use of the Bayesian evidence at all, because I think it's really good. But I think this is a rather unfair example that you've shown here.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Because the reason why you favor omega equals 1 is that you know something about the Friedmann equations, and that is a very special solution of the Friedmann equation.
Right.
And then you're saying in your second example that you can allow a flat prior on omega from point 1 to 2, also knowing the Friedmann equations, and that just doesn't make any sense at all, because that prior measure is not invariant with time evolution in the Friedmann equations.
For example.
So you've chosen just about the worst possible prior you could for this example to make the flat example
better. Up to a point, that's right, though. I mean, I could have chosen quite different prior and still got the same conclusion because the data is so strong.
Yeah. What I'm trying to say, though, is that you if you're going to choose a prior for omega on the set of possible Friedmann models, it really has to be peaked around omega is 1 somewhere.
Right. So
because that encodes your knowledge about what that system is behaving like.
So I could have chosen a different param. Yeah, and I think that's a fair comment. But this is just a hand-waving example. It's not supposed to be of any deep significance. 16? Right.
Better for him. I'm
Sixurasan from CERN. I have a very naive question, which is that you've talked about how much the data is telling you which model is right. So how much do you think you should trust the data rather than your theoretical preference for the models, which is another way of talking about the priors, of course.
Right. Yeah. I think that's an interesting question. We have theoretical judgments. So I mean, I think at some level that's encoded in the prior model probabilities. So for example, I'll show you some stuff later about comparing the Harrison-Zaldovich spectrum to varying spectral index. And I will present it in such a way as that I'm assuming these two are a priori equally likely. But you're perfectly within your rights to say that inflation is a very well-motivated theory which predicts a variable n, and there is no well-motivated theory that predicts a Harrison-Zaldovich spectrum. So you will take the position that the prior model probabilities are greatly in favor of the inflationary hypothesis. And then the data will have to be much more powerful in order to overcome your initial prejudice. So there's scope for all sorts of prejudices, if you like, in the prior information. But the interesting, I like to think of the evidence as being a kind of a differential thing. It tells you how much your prior belief was changed by the data. And everyone agrees on how much their prior belief was changed by the data, even if they don't agree what their prior belief was.
Could I just ask a naive technical question here?
Mm-hmm.
So I start with my prior being arbitrarily wide, and presumably, you know, I want to get the evidence as high as possible. So then I shrink that region, and I say, oh, that's a better model. In other words, the data is defining how it's locking in. Now, there are many things that can happen with that. Mm-hmm. For example, I can have a landscape, just to coin a phrase, which is, in fact, what one's trying to explore here often. You're trying to explore structures that exist that allow you other solutions, as well as maybe tunnels between them. Yeah. And it's not clear to me that a single number
is a good indicator, or even a one difference number is a good indicator of something that's in, that's associated with what is in effect landscape structures that exist in the probability space. Mm-hmm. And is this a good thing for exploring it? Presumably the statisticians have really gone after this, right, because after all, they're often interested in million parameter models of things mm-hmm. that have basins of probability mm-hmm. that are high.
That's correct. I think, and the only thing I'd follow up on, it was more of a comment than a question, I think you asked. You cannot really consistently use the evidence in the manner of getting to re-choose your priors to follow the data in. The evidence is really a property of the initial model, what you thought before any data came along. Now you can update it in an iterative sense, if you like, but if you do that, you have to remember that you're updating your model probabilities all the time. So before any data came in, you might have thought the models were equally likely. But if you subsequently shrink your parameter priors, at the same time, you have to remember that your model probabilities were changed by that data that caused you to shrink priors. Otherwise, the evidence never tells you anything, because if you shrink the prior onto where the data is well fit, the evidence is always going to then be the typical quality of fit to the data, and you'll never distinguish between things.
I don't want to be a stickler on the point, but you could imagine that the size of the space depends upon whether or not you've introduced a new parameter or not.
Yeah.
But you think that the effective cost function is actually a really robust way to go here, to say I don't need it?
I think it is potentially more robust than anything I've seen anyone else use.
So one of the things that I like, at least if you have a well-defined maximum, is that you, around the maximum, have an expansion which is precisely like that. That's the Fisher matrix expansion for the parameters. You rank order those parameters in terms of eigenvalues, and then the ones that have really tiny eigenvalues in the appropriate sense are ones that you say, well, I don't know how to determine this, and therefore the data doesn't demand it. And that seems to be a pretty good rank ordering criteria. And this is the issue of, is it, you know, the correlation, and is it profitable to have introduced another parameter or not?
Right. I mean, I think there again, there are two distinct things that I haven't really got my head around. The rest of it. There are the number of parameters that a particular experimental configuration can measure via principal components or whatever. And there's the number of parameters that a fundamental model has. And these are different things. So, you know, one parameter in a fundamental model might require three eigenmodes to properly describe in an observational sense. Now, do you think that you're imposing the Occam criterion on your theoretical models, or do you think you're imposing it on your experimental configuration? I think the former, not the latter.
So based on this, should we still be insisting lambda zero if the prior
was? No, lambda equals zero fits the data very badly, and so the.
But if your prior was wide enough, which get the impression it should have been, then it can beat down even 5-6 sigma.
If you thought that was your prior width, then you're welcome to do that. But you can equally think that that's
not
your
prior width.
Well, the anthropic prior on omega lambda, for example, is 120 orders of magnitude narrower. And this kind of framework, alarmingly and to my disgust, is probably quite good for implementing these kind of anthropic arguments. I mean, there's been no point in human history where anyone thought that lambda equals 10 to the 120 was actually a viable model of the universe. And there's no point, at the same time as you can't allow your model priors to follow the data in, equally you can't artificially include lots of models that you never thought were going to fit the data. The whole point of the evidence is that you have a set of models that you thought were plausible before the data came in, and it's shrunk by some amount by the data. And you are rewarded for how predictive you were within your set of models before the data came in.
Okay. So take a different example, LRGs, and you have a one parameter model, sigma 8, fitting to these galaxies. What would it say about adding a bias? What would this
adding a bias
type of thinking say about adding a bias?
you think, what compilation of data set was required? I don't know the answer to that. I can answer a different question that I was hoping you were about to ask, which is that the evidence does support the measurement of baryon oscillations in the LRG spectrum. If you can compare the evidence of a fit with no baryons, which just completely ignores that peak, and a fit that does include the peak, you find the evidence favors it. So if you didn't already believe the universe had baryons in it, and admittedly you probably did believe that, but if you didn't, then that data set would be good enough to convince you that they did. But the bias, I don't know what the answer is to that. That would require an actual calculation, so I'm not going to try and second guess it.
Can you speak up?
So did we understand your question? If you only have the luminous red galaxies and you want to measure from them sigma 8, and then you ask, do I need a bias? The two are completely degenerate, aren't they?
Yeah.
If you have just that data set.
Yeah, you need another data set, obviously, to pick up the bias, because it's the relative normalization of two different things.
But if you don't have any evidence for the bias, it seems possible that you could conclude you shouldn't add it, and therefore you'd get a very precise measurement of sigma 8. And the reason I chose LRGs is because the bias isn't anywhere near 1, and your sigma 8 would be way wrong. So if that was the only observation.
Okay, but if that isn't the only observation. If that was the only observation, then you might convince yourself you didn't need the bias. I'm sure in the 1980s people briefly thought they maybe didn't need the bias. But when more data comes along, like the CMB, it tells you there's an amplitude mismatch between the two, and that requires you to have the bias. But again, I mean, you shouldn't let a pile of statistics overrule your physical ability to understand how physics happens. Bias is clearly predicted by physical models, and so you'd be mad to try and use statistics to prove that it didn't exist.
I'm exploring this. So,
so I want to ask you about the running, because the delta chi squared between the model without WMAP with and without running is 4. So if I believe BIC, even roughly, then that would seem to be
running. Yeah.
Indication for adding that extra parameter.
That's right. Yeah, there are several examples of this, but yes, model selection would not have supported running in the original WMAP data, and certainly doesn't support us in any revised version of WMAP or extended data set.
No, but I'm saying it does.
Because
the criterion for adding one parameter, k log n, would be 3 times 1. And if delta chi squared is 4, then...
I don't know what you think. The n is the number of data points,
yeah,
which is potentially 50 or something in a bin.
Well, then that's even better.
So the penalty is bigger than the improvement to the chi squared. The chi squared is improved by 2 in the likelihood term.
I'm saying chi squared is improved by 4.
Or 4.
Yeah.
But you're losing 7... in the penalty term.
Oh, it's the
when you compute the evidence, it's actually worse, though there is a prior dependence there.
Okay.
But I think it's fair to, I mean, the rank order is against running. And even if it wasn't, the difference wouldn't be significant with current data. So a kind of post hoc success of model selection, had anyone thought about it at the time, probably the WMAP running stuff wouldn't have appeared the way that it has done if people had used model selection. And probably it would have been right that it didn't appear the way it did, because I think probably you don't believe in running anymore, at least from the current data set. I don't know. 2 sigma is never enough. You can prove that in Gaussian examples. This is an example.
It's enough to stimulate a lot of theoretical papers.
Right.
It's not necessarily a bad thing.
Okay. So we've got another question, sorry.
Professor Little.
Professor Frampton.
If I may be allowed to ask a question about 1 or 2 transparencies ago, because I probably have to leave before the end. About the number of neutrinos. You had a... we know from measurements at LEP, from the invisible width of the Z, that the number of neutrinos is, I think, by now 3.00. And I'm not sure if the third decimal place is 0, but I think the second one is. And we know from very general considerations that the number of neutrinos is an integer.
You were.
So why does... Isn't it perverse of CMB FAST to parameterize the number of neutrinos as a difference from 3.04?
The reason for the 3.04 is there's a thermal correction to the abundance of neutrinos. they're not actually in a perfect black body spectrum, and you can compensate for them that slight discrepancy by attributing an extra 1% of energy density. And CMB fast happens to do that by adding in that amount. So it's a fiddle.
It's a fiddle.
And neutrino mass at some point is presumably going to become a required parameter for cosmological models as well.
It looks odd to a particle.
It looks odd to us too.
An accurate fiddle.
Yeah, let me just try and find where I was. That's what I was doing. So I've got another example I thought I'd mention. I just put this in this morning in response to what Olivier was saying. What I'm about to say has nothing to do with, well, I agree with what I'm going to say, obviously, but I'm just making a point that was made by Nyarku, Jaffe, and Pogosian a couple of years ago about this data point here. As Olivier said, is probably something like 95% unlikely, i.e. 2 sigma or so unlikely. And he then discussed various physical models for maybe trying to take account of that low quadrupole. However, in the context of model selection, introducing new physics, broken power spectrum or whatever, to explain that data point requires extra parameters. And the Bayesian statistics will penalize you for those extra parameters. And because this discrepancy is only at the 95% level, the penalty for introducing the extra parameter will always be greater. And therefore, you will always find that a model with extra physics that tries to fit this data will be unpreferred. So model selection actually tells you it is futile to try and explain this particular piece of data using physics. Right. That's right, yes. If you can find a... Then that would be fine. That would be fine. And even if it was less parameters, that would be good. That's not what Olivier discussed this morning. We discussed adding extra physical mechanisms to reduce this. But though arguably the trans-Planckian effect might not be an extra parameter. That might just be something you ought to include. But yeah, of course I agree with what you're saying. Just thought I'd mention if you're adding extra stuff. You actually will not get yourself anywhere according to these arguments. Okay, just in passing, since we've been talking about 2 sigma, you all know that 95% confidence results are not to be believed at 95% confidence. I know it, you know it. I might be exaggerating a little bit to say that 95% of 95% confidence detections are wrong, but certainly more than 5% of them are wrong. And I thought it was briefly worth just wondering why that is true, because everyone thinks they're very careful with their statistics, so why is it that none of our 95% confidence results ever stand up to them anything? There's another statement that the particle physicists have a saying which is roughly equivalent to this, I believe, which is that once the result gets to 3 sigma, you have about a half chance of it being right. So why is that? I just thought I'd mention a few reasons so you can think about them. Reasons why: statistical fluke is not the reason, because we're all very careful with our error bars, and statistical fluke is the thing that our error bars are supposed to incorporate. So if you've done your errors correctly, that's not the reason. But this might be. Publication bias is very well known in the field of medical trials, that it's much easier to publish positive results than negative results. And if you can do lots and lots of trials, then this effect accumulates. And it's taken very, very seriously in the medical field, as many of you may know, that drug companies are in future going to be required to lodge all test results, positive or negative, with a central database so that people can carry out so-called meta-analyses, which includes negative test results in combined statistics in order to figure out which treatments really do work and which ones don't. And the phenomenon here is that essentially a large number of treatments which have no actual effects in improving people's health get approved. And indeed, treatments which are actively unhealthy for people sometimes get approved on the back of publication bias. Very important in medical trials. Whether it's really important in cosmology, I'm not sure. It is potentially important, I think, for non-Gaussianity, where a very large number of tests have been carried out. it's almost certainly not important for cosmological models because there just aren't enough parameters for there to be lots of negative results that people have done and not published. So that's a possibility. Another possibility well worth bearing in mind is what I've called inappropriate a posteriori reasoning. Basically, this is the art of choosing something interesting after the data's arrived and then figuring out its confidence on the basis of some Monte Carlo simulations. And of course, this neglects all the other possible interesting features that might have happened in the data that you didn't test for. It's quite closely related to this. So, you know, when this morning we heard of a non-Gaussianity test that was at something like 5 × 10⁻⁵ probability or something like that. And no one here batted an eyelid about whether that, you know, no one thought that really meant it was super certain, because we all reckoned that there were probably lots of other things that could have come up in the data. It was the quadrupole octupole alignment of D'Oliveira Costa, I think.
Do you agree there is a difference between like a lot of people?
Yes. I do. I agree absolutely. I just mentioned this is something that can happen. I'm not particularly attributing it to things, but I guess I was mentioning the D'Oliveira Costa alignment thing, but. Yeah, and there's no doubt that if you find something interesting, one way to reconcile it is to discover a new physical effect which makes the prediction. And we all believe probably that it's much more likely you'd find some physical effect aligning the second, third, fourth, and fifth multiples than finding a physical effect that aligned the 83rd multiple with the 127th multiple. So because of So that's another possibility. And the other possibility is the one that I've been talking about, which is neglect of model dimensionality, or, put another way, using two sigma thresholds that are inconsistent with Bayesian inference or other inference mechanisms. Incidentally, I guess I meant to say earlier, I should have maybe highlighted back when I was talking about spatial curvature. If there's one message that you could take away from what I've been saying, I've said that this threshold for detection for requiring a new parameter depends on the data and on the priors. It depends on the data in particular, and unfortunately, the way it depends on the data is that the better your data set is, the higher the threshold has to be before that parameter is going to be correct. This is counterintuitive, right? You're sitting in the room. You would think that if you wanted a 3-sigma result, you'd be much better off with a 3-sigma result from a really, really good data set that really constrained your parameters than a 3-sigma result from a lousy data set. But you'd be wrong. The 3-sigma result from the lousy data set is much more likely to be correct than the 3-sigma result from the really good data set. You should bear that in mind. Incidentally, 4-sigma results are almost always correct, independent of the data set. It's between 2 and 4 sigma is where model selection is likely to overturn a frequentist likelihood ratio result. Okay, I want to end by some actual examples that we've been doing recently. We've been spending some time doing different things at Sussex. So the first one I want to tell you a bit is now about a year old, some work we're doing on isocurvature modes. So what I'm doing is taking as read that the density perturbations, I've got my base cosmological model, which either is the Harrison-Zeldovich spectrum or just a power loss spectrum of adiabatic perturbations. And I want to ask, is there any observational evidence that would suggest that I should include isocurvature modes, or better, how strong is the observational evidence against there being isocurvature modes of any amplitude at all? One of the things to stress about all this model selection stuff is when you do parameter estimation, you just get to set ever more strong upper limits on things like the amplitude of isocurvature modes. But you never get to say there are no isocurvature modes. Whereas in model selection, you actually can accumulate positive support for the simpler model. So the accumulated data can actually favor the adiabatic model over the isocurvature models at some very high ratio. And the reason is reasonably straightforward. The added point is just if you thought the isocurvature model could have been anywhere between 0 amplitude and the same amplitude as the adiabatic perturbations, but observations have forced you into a 1% upper limit, it's very unlikely that the true model would lie in just in that tiny corner where you've not been able to detect it, rather than in the region you've already excluded with the data. can tell I didn't explain that very well, because even Dick is frowning at me. But it's true. So we did an analysis. This was with Maria Beltran, who's a student visiting at Sussex. Yes?
In the sense that if I have a prior that says that this is all possible, then and then you do your measurement, which tells you, in fact, there is a result here, but it's just in this kind of parameter. Should you go back and change your original prior?
If you find it what you're saying, I mean, everything I'm saying is probabilities. Observations can always overturn what you get. So in my spatial curvature example, literal interpretation of the example as I gave it is that spatial curvature is 20 times less likely than there being no spatial curvature. That is positive. So there is positive evidence to an odds ratio of 20 to 1 in favor of the flat universe.
If in working through different data sets that are giving upper limits, am I then about to say, no, we can't include isocurvature before I actually get to the actual detection that's down here? Because it's just got to be.
Well, it's saying that it is you'd be saying from the data that it's unlikely that you will ever make a detection. It's not impossible you will, but the odds are turning against you because all that region where you might have made a detection, you didn't. And remember, there's 20 plus cosmological parameters. Some large number of them are irrelevant to our universe. And if you want, you can keep pressing down the upper limits over orders and orders of magnitude, or you can decide at some point that those parameters are just not interesting to you, and that it's time to go away and do exoplanets or something else instead. Isocurvature. For those of you who know this stuff, you know it. There are three observationally distinct kinds of isocurvature modes: cold dark matter, neutrino, and neutrino velocity isocurvature modes. And the analysis we did, what we did was we didn't allow a general isocurvature mode, which would be a superposition of these. We just allowed one of the types of modes to coexist with the adiabatic perturbations. Even just allowing one type introduces four extra parameters to the model because you have a new spectrum, it has an amplitude and a spectral index, and also has a correlation with the adiabatic perturbations, which itself has an amplitude and a spectral index as well. And we keep those general. Sometimes people make the spectral indices the same, but there's no theoretical motivation to do that. So we've got these isocurvature models, and we're comparing them with, we actually did two adiabatic models. One is the Harrison-Zaldovich case, and the other is the varying spectral index model that people have been talking about. So how did we do it? This is old stuff. So what we did was use an off-the-shelf technique called thermodynamic integration. The gist here is to compute the Bayesian evidence, it's the average likelihood over the prior distribution. You cannot use normal parameter estimation chains, Monte Carlo Markov chains, because those chains are always highly localized in the region where the likelihood is high, and they don't probe the tails of the distribution. It turns out that for typical distributions, the tails don't fall off fast enough that you can ignore them, so you cannot just estimate the evidence directly from the posterior chains. You can do okay in some cases, but you can't compute it accurately. So the method of choice in statistics literature, which is very general, is one called thermodynamic integration, and which is another Monte Carlo method, but what you do is you heat the chain, and as you heat the chain, it becomes able to explore the parameter space more widely. And there's a way of doing it where you can you basically interpolate from the posterior distribution to the prior distribution as you heat the chain. And and you can then accumulate the evidence as a numerical integral. So this is done a lot in the statistics literature. It's part of the Bayes package, for example. The trouble is it is extraordinarily inefficient. We tested quite a few variants on this. And one of the things we have to take on board as cosmologists is we're in a very different regime from typical statistics problems. A normal statistics problem may have many parameters, but it tends to be characterized by a complicated likelihood surface with multiple maxima, but very, very quick likelihood evaluations, so that they don't really care whether it takes a billion likelihood evaluations to explore that surface. And thermodynamic integration is very much that kind of method. In cosmology, our likelihood evaluations are very expensive. Anyone who's done a parameter estimation run knows that typically you do 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6 likelihood evaluations by running it on some modest supercomputer. It turns out to get accurate results from thermodynamic integration, you actually need 10 to the 7 likelihood evaluations. And we probably have overkill here. We're too accurate, so we have done a bit too many. But it's an order of magnitude bigger as a computational problem than a typical parameter estimation problem. And that very much sticks us into the supercomputer class. So for the results I'll show you, for each model we computed, it took 1 week of processing time on 32 processors on Cosmos in Cambridge. So it was a week of wall clock time per model, and we did 5 models then. So it was really quite a lot of computer time. Before showing you the results, which will make you laugh, I better just show you an interpretive scale, however. What are these results going to mean? I'm computing the evidence for different models so that I can compare them, and there'll be a ranking of models according to their evidence. The ranking's a good thing because you get an ordered list. You don't have to set a threshold. But nevertheless, you do still have to decide how different the evidence is before you're going to think it's significant. The evidence ratio is just the probability ratio, or the change in the probability ratio. But what everyone tends to use is this thing called the Jeffries scale. It goes back to Harold Jeffries' classic book of 1961 in Appendix B. And these are exactly the phrases he uses. If the difference in log evidence is within 1, you can mention it, but you shouldn't think anything of it at all. And then as it increases, based on his experience, this was the scale he went through. And once it gets to 5, the evidence is decisive. In terms of a probability ratio, a log evidence of 5 is odds of about 150-1 against the weaker model. So it's much stronger than 95% confidence, if you like, which lies at about 3.5, I think, so in this zone here. Yeah. So that's what we did. What does that say? Oh yeah, I mentioned the results depend on the priors, and in this case, we actually, for isocurvature, you have 4 parameters. You actually have to worry quite a bit about the priors. So we did 2 different parameterizations just to see how robust the results are. Here are the results. Then you ready? One week of 32 processors computation for each one. Just read 2. There you are. Both 0. I've actually normalized them, so it's not quite 0. The actual value was this, but nevertheless, the evidence for these 2 models turned out to be identical for the data compilation we were using, which was essentially the standard one. The evidence cannot distinguish between them. The isocurvature ones, what about them? Well, it's also inconclusive. So the isocurvature models are disfavored, but they're only 1 less than the adiabatic models, which is just at the edge of hardly worth mentioning and the beginning of maybe you should pay a little attention to this. In a second parameterization we used, they're actually a little bit more disfavored, but none of these results are of any particular significance. So the conclusion of this comparison is that at the moment, there is no reason to think that isocurvature models are ruled out. Although we haven't seen any indication that they exist, it's perfectly plausible to believe that they are there. And one thing you should realize from looking at this comparison, there's 4 extra parameters in this model, and yet the evidence is hardly down at all. That's telling you the isocurvature models are actually fitting the data significantly better than the adiabatic models. That's not obvious in everyone's analysis because people tend to fix the spectral indices of the correlations and the isocurvature perturbation to be the same, which we don't. And having them different greatly helps you fit the observational data. But anyway, inconclusive. And even worse, it took an enormous amount of computing time. So we went back to the drawing board and decided that we needed a much better algorithm for computing the evidence, which took into account that likelihood evaluations are expensive. And luckily, one had been invented by a guy called John Skilling, who used to work in the inference group at the Cavendish Lab. And so we spent, this is now with my postdocs, Pia Mukherjee and David Parkinson, spent quite a lot of time implementing the nested sampling routine in order to calculate the evidence. I'll show you briefly what it is. I realize I've reset my clock, so I have no idea what the time is. But what he basically does is just one clever trick. This is the evidence as I wrote it before. But he just changes to variable x, which measures the fraction of the prior volume which has been explored. And by doing that, you know, it's just a change of variable from theta to x, but it makes a 1-dimensional integral rather than a 10-dimensional integral. And the point here is that the likelihoods are ordered. So one way to think about this is you take your prior volume, and you break it up into a very large number of individual particles and associate a likelihood with each of them. And then you order them by likelihood, so you line them all up with increasing likelihood. And that's the function that you're integrating here. So I shall draw it like this. So basically, I suppose we have just a two-dimensional parameter space. What you do is you populate this space with points where you're going to evaluate the likelihood. And what you do is you throw away the lowest likelihood point and replace it with a point of higher likelihood. What that means is that you're basically drawing contours of constant likelihood in this space. And that lets you evaluate this as a numerical integral here. So you're basically peeling apart, it's like an onion, you're peeling apart the likelihood surface towards the center. All of the difficult bits about implementing this was actually the replacement points have to be chosen uniformly from the prior distribution. And none of the standard Monte Carlo methods draw samples uniformly. They always draw them with some Gaussian probability. And most of our time was trying to solve that problem. But we managed to solve it. So the way that this works is that you walk a set of points. And in our cosmological examples, it would be about 300 points. And you start by having them distributed all throughout the prior volume, so most of them are in low likelihood regions. And you use this replacement scheme to walk them into the region of high likelihood. And it's a little bit like in MCMC, you hop to higher likelihood. But there you're just walking one single point into the middle and bouncing it around. Here you're taking a cluster of points, and you're not letting them walk backwards and forwards. They're always drifting to higher likelihood. So here's the movie just to show you. This is a Gaussian example with less than 300 points and just in two dimensions. But the points are being replaced. The high likelihood region's in the middle here. It's Gaussian likelihood. The integral is being accumulated here. Every time you replace a point, you're moving to smaller volumes in the middle. You've got your likelihood, and so you add them all up. And eventually, after a while, the points have all walked into the middle of the parameter space. You've got your whole curve here and the evidence of the integral under that curve. It's a very clever method. As I say, the only hard bit is getting this uniform sampling to work, but managed to do that. So recently we published a paper basically redoing work I'd done previously with the information criteria, looking at some simple cosmological models. And here all I want to do is compare a few cosmological models with the simplest cosmological model, which is the Harrison-Zaldovich case. So here's the table. So what we've got here is the Harrison-Zaldovich model, five parameters. Then we add the spectral index variation here, about two different versions with different priors to compare them. Here we add dark energy equation of state variation, and here we add both spectral index and dark energy. The bottom line is still this evidence here at the bottom. This is slightly different data compilation to the one in the previous table I showed you. What you see is that the Harrison-Zaldovich model is the best. It has the highest evidence. It is the preferred fit to current data. Other models all do worse, but again, not at any particular significance level here. So although this is the best model, the spectral index is by no means excluded as a possibility. It just hasn't been measured yet. But the other important thing to look at is the number of likelihood evaluations here. This is in units of 10 to the 4. So typically, there's 10 to the 5 likelihood evaluations done in these calculations. The method is 100 times more efficient than thermodynamic integration and is no longer a supercomputer problem. These calculations can now be done quite quickly. And we're hoping in reasonably short order to make the code publicly available in case other people are interested in using it to compute the evidence of their models. Instead, I should mention in passing, this method can also provide posterior samples as well, and it's quite interesting. It provides them with non-integer weights, unlike MCMC. It's not quite as good as the standard Metropolis-Hastings algorithm for doing it, but it's also not bad, and if you were computing the evidence anyway, you get the posterior samples for free, so that's quite a good thing. Dick, I've reset my clock, and I don't know what the time is. How long have I got? Okay, I only have two slides, I think. So that sounds right, man. Okay, last thing I want to mention. I've talked a lot about current data, and it's always a bit awkward talking about data because people do have different views about priors. I want to go off in a slightly different direction and mention this, the power of model selection, not for analyzing data that exists, but for projecting how good upcoming experiments might be. The thing I'm going to focus on for this talk is actually dark energy surveys, because there's been a lot of interest over the summer about different proposals for dark energy surveys in the future. So how do you figure out how good your survey is going to be? What everyone's been doing for years and years and years, back to Lloyd Knox starting it off for CMB, is forecast errors using a Fisher matrix approach. So what you do here is you basically simulate data as best as you can for some particular fiducial model. So for dark energy studies, this might be lambda CDM. It's essentially always lambda CDM. And what you then do is you estimate the expected parameter uncertainties about that model by figuring out the Fisher information matrix and then approximating the likelihood as Gaussian using it. And what you then do is you interpret these contours as excluding the models which are outside the contours. As I will show my next slide, this process is actually logically inconsistent in several ways. I'm not sure whether any of them are serious or not. But using model selection, you can do something which is not logically inconsistent. And what we're going to do, and I only have one preliminary picture to show you, is use a Bayes factor approach. The Bayes factor is the ratio of the evidences. So when I say Bayes factor, it's just a comparison of two models shown in a plane. So what we're going to do is, rather than simulate data for one fiducial model, we're going to plot the same sort of parameter plane, but we're going to simulate data at every point in that plane. And at each point in the plane, what we're going to do is ask how well could the experiment distinguish between the lambda CDM model and the actual model at that point in the plane. So I'm going to use a two-parameter dark energy model to do this. So philosophically, it's quite a different approach, though you'll see that the result doesn't look particularly different at the end. There. So I'll remind you what the Fisher information matrix drawbacks are in case you either haven't realized that they exist or have just haven't thought about it before. I thought four. I think there's more than four, but it's a few. The first one is that, I've said it, most of us don't actually care what the values of parameters are. The reason why we want to do new experiments like a dark energy survey is not because we want to measure some parameter to 0.001% accuracy. It's because we want to discover new physical effects which need new parameters to describe them. For instance, the W of dark energy. So the motivation for these experiments is not parameter estimation, which the Fisher matrix tells you about, it's model selection, the need for new parameters. The second thing is that when people look at these Fisher matrix plots, what they really want to interpret is the experiment's ability to rule out lambda CDM. You know, the people don't really think of their plots as saying that they're going to show that lambda CDM is good with upper limits given by these contours. They want to know whether or not they'll discover dark energy evolution. But unfortunately, they've not simulated that data. They've simulated lambda CDM data, not the data for the model they're actually going to try and say is the true model to be compared to lambda CDM. Another thing, this is really a model selection point. From a model selection point of view, lambda CDM has a special status. It's a lower dimensional model which is well motivated as distinct from the dark energy model. In a parameter estimation exercise, that's not recognized at all. The way in which you would say that lambda CDM is ruled out is just the same criterion as the way you'd say that, say, W is 0.99 is ruled out. You'd look for the 95% confidence contour and ask whether your model's inside it or not. You can do that if you like, but you are failing to recognize a special status for the lambda CDM model, which I think it deserves. And the final point is that the Fisher matrix approach normally in implementations assumes a Gaussian likelihood. So you evaluate the Fisher matrix around the fiducial model, and then you assume it's Gaussian. That might be a good approximation, but it might not be. So we're doing the Bayes factor plot instead. The Bayes factor plot overcomes all of these criticisms. It's a model selection exercise. You're comparing the ability of the experiment to detect new parameters. We're going to simulate the data at each point in the parameter space and explicitly ask at that point in parameter space, if that was the true model, would I be able to rule out lambda CDM against the true model? The third point is model selection again. And the fourth point is there's no need to make a Fisher information approximation. You can if you want, but you can compute the evidence completely using nested sampling, for example. So this is what things look like. This is an unfair comparison. It's provisional. I'm using a graph we made a couple of days ago. I'm comparing it with a graph which has not been made by us, so it's not at all a level playing field. So I want you just to get the concept of what I'm saying, not the result. If you draw my figure, don't draw the axis. But what we do, we use this parameterization, the scale factor parameterization of dark energy. So it's two parameters. And the model comparison I'm going to make is a model where these two parameters are freely variable and to be fit from the data versus a lambda CDM model. So I stole this from one of the SNAP collaboration papers. This is a typical Fisher matrix plot. I'm only interested here in the blue, which is the SNAP supernovae plus Planck. The other one is including weak lensing, and I don't know how to do that. So this is the sort of thing you typically see. The two parameters are here. Lambda CDM has been simulated. These are the projected uncertainties with and without systematics around that point. I say the interpretation that people want to have of this is that if the true model was here, say, then you could rule out lambda CDM. But you haven't actually simulated the data at that point. And there's no reason why the error bars here should have to be the same size as the error bars around this point. In general, they won't be. So what do? We compute the base factor, and this is what it looks like. Now, you can't compare the contour levels, really. It's the same thing, so W naught this way, WA going this way. This is me and collaborators. It's not quite the same. This is also SNAP supernovae, taken from the fiducial SNAP mission. But we impose a prior on omega matter. This says that they use Planck data, and I suspect it's Planck data used just to put a prior on omega matter, which may or may not be the same as ours. But we will remake this plot using our data so that it is a fair comparison. But this is ours, and we have three contour levels here, and this is something that you get out of model selection. The red area is the area where lambda CDM would be favored over a model which lay there. Now, if lambda CDM itself was correct, then obviously you expect that that's what the data will show you. What this also shows you is even if the true model was up here, a model selection analysis would actually prefer the lambda CDM model. And the reason is that the lambda CDM model would be almost as good at fitting the data, but it would have two fewer parameters. Only when you reach the edge of this red zone does the data start to favor the dark energy model rather than the lambda CDM model. And only once you get outside the blue zone do the data decisively prefer the dark energy model against the lambda CDM model. So the outer line here is actually the zone outside which you want the true model to be if this configuration of the SNAP mission is to be able to detect the dark energy model. Now I'm going to try and slide this across here. These are not quite on the same scale, but luckily my fantastic Macintosh will allow me to distort it. And so this is where our curve lies, and then I can fade it with any luck as well, so you can see it. So now I think I don't know how to interpret this extra lens. It may be an artifact of us not doing a proper comparison, so don't read anything into it. But the sort of things you see is it's not going to make a huge difference. Particularly, we pick out the same general degeneracy direction here, where supernova experiments are not very good at distinguishing between models. We actually seem to have a somewhat narrower width in this direction, I think, because our contour levels are very strong. This is 5 in log evidence, 150 to 1 odds, whereas I believe this contour is probably just 1 sigma uncertainty. That big difference may be something to do with why ours is much more extended in this direction. But anyway, it's the concept I want to interest you in, not the precise numbers. I hope within a few weeks we'll have a proper comparison, and also that we will have several experiments, not just SNAP. The reason for doing this is that this technique is another way of making an objective comparison between different dark energy missions. Richa?
Could you elaborate a second on what is the difference between what you are doing and simply say, I want to test the null hypothesis. I'm going to sit on a lambda CDM model and then see. So my null hypothesis is the lambda CDM model.
The principal difference between these two plots is that in the Fisher matrix plot, the only data which is simulated is the lambda CDM model. In our model, case, we're simulating the dark energy model, not the lambda CDM model. So the literal interpretation of this plot is that you can test the lambda CDM null hypothesis, but you cannot automatically say that you would be able to exclude lambda CDM if you were outside the contours of that null hypothesis, because the error bars are not symmetric, because the experiments, you know, as you shift your fiducial model, then the Fisher matrix changes. It's a function of the fiducial model. So the error bars may widen as you move your fiducial model off in some parameter direction. That's not shown in this plot. Sometimes people plot more than one fiducial model, but then all the contours start overlapping. Ours is what people want to do. What people want to do is quantify how well their experiment can rule out lambda CDM, not how well it can support lambda CDM as a null hypothesis, which is what Fisher Metrics does. And so the principal difference is that we're simulating dark energy models, different model at each point, and comparing those with the lambda CDM model. It's quite different. But that's not right, but that's not what's up. If you want to test the null hypothesis, let's see what you're saying. What you can say, it's the opposite null hypothesis, if you like. We're trying to rule out lambda CDM. In the Fisher matrix, you're trying to rule out non-lambda CDM. Right. Right. Yeah. Right. That is another way to put it. I'm not sure if everyone heard about the testing null hypothesis. This Fisher information matrix contour will correctly show you how strong an upper limit you get, provided you are unable to rule out lambda CDM. It will tell you what the upper limits will be on the parameters. If that's what you want to find out, then that's fine. That's not what I want to find out. I want to find out where would the true model have to be in parameter space so that I could rule out lambda CDM at a certain confidence level. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. So by stress, we all want to make a measurement. We don't all want to test a null hypothesis, I believe. Okay, I'm essentially done, I think. So, like I say, I don't really have any idea of what the time is, but these are my conclusions. I don't have to read them out. Okay, we're done then. Yeah. Thanks, everyone. No, they can read it.
Well, we are all statisticians at heart, then.
Okay.
Just since you finished, it's a general question. One of the striking features of the standard model is that 96% of the model is invisible, has not been detected. Mm-hmm. And in fact, one can argue that the cosmological constant is proportional to the vacuum energy. And you can argue that the vacuum energy, that vacuum energy can never be measured in a lab, so to speak. So in the event that we someday understand this strange situation as a theorist, how would this affect this parameter fitting? This possibly refers back to Robert Bratt's question, namely, the Ptolemaic model of the solar system actually works. It's just that we know it's incorrect.
Yeah.
And in this sense, when we understand what the 96% of the model is, the standard model is, we have no understanding at all at present about it. How will this affect us?
That's our misfortune, I think, that we don't understand the model. And either we will come to understand the ingredients of the model as currently specified, or we will come to understand the model as wrong. But within this approach, only two things can really happen to the standard model, I think. Someone can come along with a simpler model that fits the data as well, that we just haven't thought of so far. And that simpler model, however it's constructed, will become the standard cosmological model. The alternative is that someone comes along with a model which may be as complicated or more complicated, but which fits the data much better. I think there is little prospect for that with current data, because the models we have already fit the data very well, the chi-squared per degree of freedoms of order 1. So the scope to improve the fit to the data through a more complicated model is very limited. Future data, that may not be true anymore. With future data, we may find that our current model stops being a very good fit at that higher precision, and then further parameters have to be introduced. And that, I think, most people would see as perhaps the most likely eventuality, and that would be the way in which new cosmological understanding would arise and new physical mechanisms would be understood, such as the spectral index of density perturbations maybe telling us something about inflation, which is, you know, the downside about inflation, which I never really came back to, is we haven't measured the spectral index, we haven't measured the tensor to scalar ratio, so although the circumstantial evidence that inflation took place is very good, there is no quantitative understanding of inflation. And if anything, in a certain sense, WMAP is bad news, because its failure to find information about inflation not only is a disappointment in itself, but in this sense makes it less likely that future observations will be able to discover things about inflation.
Well, just final. The point is that 96% of the standard model has not been detected. So how many parameters does that, in effect, be equivalent to? You see what I'm saying?
Right. Well, I mean, it's been detected in the sense that the gravitational effects of dark matter and dark energy have been detected in astronomical observations. And we are assuming in these models that just two parameters are sufficient to describe all of their physical effects, being the densities of the two. We may come to understand at a later time that dark matter needs a more complicated description. It might have interactions or decay, and then it has more parameters, and you have to ask whether or not these extra parameters are justified by the improvement in the fit to whatever data you have gives you. I can see you're not satisfied, but I can't help, I'm afraid. It's not my fault, it's the universe.
I have a question which is along the same lines, but basically I can see two deficiencies with this approach. And the first one is exactly that you care about the number of parameters, but you don't get penalized for not understanding the model. And there should be some penalty for that.
Well, that's the prior model probability.
Yeah. And well, the second thing is, so the example of dark matter is, you know, it's actually quite a big assumption, and somehow the formalism is blind about that. That you really ignore, you really don't know what you're doing, essentially. Yeah. Okay, but the second thing is also another deficiency is that the underlying statistical process in most of this stuff has got to be Gaussian. Although the dependence on the parameters is not Gaussian, It's extremely difficult to do any kind of Bayesian modeling in which the likelihood of the underlying process is not Gaussian. Mm. And, you know, so if you're actually testing Gaussianity, you cannot use this formalism to begin with. So there's a number of assumptions which are folded into the formalism.
Right. And,
you're assuming that, and you cannot actually evaluate how well tested they are with the formalism.
You're right. There's two parts there. There's the shape of the likelihood, and nested sampling doesn't care about what shape it is. It doesn't have to be Gaussian. But the terms in the likelihood function itself are often assumed to be Gaussian distributed, and only occasionally, like at the low Ls, the Cls, do people try and do something better than that. But yeah, your data analysis can only be as good as the information you put in. And if you think it's crucial that you improve that, then you're welcome to do it.
No, I just think it's extremely difficult to test one of the assumptions of this whole formalism, using the formalism itself. I mean, there's no way to leave it, to depart it. You could have something like an Edgeworth expansion, but that's intractable. Yeah. But there's no other way to actually have a likelihood which goes, which has all these parameters.
I sort of agree. I mean, this isn't the end of the story, but I think it's a step in the right direction.
The formalism
allows you to ask and answer questions which cannot be asked or answered under parameter estimation methods. Whether you like the answers, I don't know, but at least you can get them.
Well, I think that we should close up this part, and there will be ample opportunity over the wine and beer and whatever else is going to be done at 5:30, more or less. Depends upon Marco. Marco Peloso is going to talk about reheating and thermalization and inflation, and we will only be a little bit past our 5:30 target.